The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
Show release day. If you have a PS4, you're listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Midwest Swing on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. You can find Cold Omaha, now Zone Coverage, on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon_Warren. Behind the proverbial glass producing today, Tom Schreier, co-founder of Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage. Tom, you can be found on Twitter at TSchreier3. You probably knew that.
Yeah.
But
yep.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. We had a good podcast with Mike Gelfand.
Yeah. Check that out. That is the Cold Omaha staff podcast. We broke down our brackets. Mine was already sufficiently broken.
UNC, UNC, baby.
I'm so disappointed, though. My entire Elite Eight was intact when we met last week, and then it all blew up in my face. So anyway, now it's time to get excited about baseball. Yesterday, we were 1 week away from the Minnesota Twins season and home opener at Target Field. It's going to be Irvin Santana. It's going to be Danny Duffy. Today, we are joined by someone who will be in the press box, I suspect. I have no reason to believe otherwise. Pat Borzi has jumped in to join us. I love having guests in studio.
I know.
It's one of my favorite things because the phone... First of all, you got that intergalactic delay sometimes, like we have with that one podcast
with
Mike.
Sometimes it just cuts out.
But... It's great to have guests because you can kind of read their facial cues. You can bounce things back and forth a little bit more. So Pat, who flew in from Fort Myers last night, has been gracious enough to join us today. How are you doing today?
I'm fabulous. How are you?
I'm just doing dandy. I'm pretty excited to have you on here. This is the criminally underfollowed Pat Borzi on Twitter.
Don't start with that.
You can find him
a lot of followers.
At BorzMN. That's BorzMN. You contribute to Min Post. You see you on the is it the New York Post? You will stream for
Times.
New York Times. Is it a crime? Like, am I looked at very negatively if I mix up papers?
If you mix up the Post and the Times, that's not good.
I was going to say a little different.
Well, we're off to a swing and a miss, bad start here. But you obviously have done some fun work. Locally, nationally, all kinds of fun stuff. You are also now just fresh off the plane from Fort Myers. How did Fort Myers treat you this last? I think you were there for almost a week?
Just about, yeah. It was, you know, it's fine. You know, Fort Myers is a pretty nice, you know, little southwest Florida town. There's some good places to eat. And you see some plenty of opportunities to watch baseball. It's pretty low key. You know, it's fine.
How many games did you see while you were down there?
I think it was five, so... Well, of course, I know it was five. I mean, it'd be pretty difficult if I can't count to five. I haven't had quite enough coffee today. I got in very, very late last night, so I apologize. I'm a little slow on the draw, but I think we're going to be okay. I'll muddle through here.
It's an interesting cover, right? Because you don't have the emotions, I assume, after the game, given that they don't really matter and the players are mostly working on different things that they probably won't even do during the season. How different? I mean, we've covered the Twins for a while in games that count, or at least are supposed to matter. And how different is it covering the games down there? How does the coverage change?
Well, the thing that changes is that basically after about the sixth inning, you stop paying attention because generally the starters are only playing the first five or six innings. The starting pitchers, I mean, at the beginning, they'll pitch two innings, maybe three, and then they go farther along. What's unusual about spring training compared to the regular season is that you're allowed to go down to the clubhouse during the game and interview the starting pitcher. So generally, once that happens, you're kind of busy writing your story and you're not really paying all that much attention to what else is going on. I mean, the other night we talked to Santiago, who had pitched, and so when we were down there talking to him, we missed the inning that Craig Breslow pitched, and I was kind of looking forward to watching him pitch because I had not seen him. I know he's a really, really bright guy. I had a nice visit with him the day before. I felt bad, and I told him this, because when he came through the Twins the last time, he was there such a short period of time that I never talked to him. And he's a really brilliant guy, as you guys know. He went to Yale. Mm-hmm. He's really, really intelligent, has really good opinions, and is a savvy baseball guy. And he's here largely because he's big on all the different kinds of pitching analytics. And one of the reasons that I think that he's here and why Chris Gimenez is here is because they're big analytics guys. And I think what they want to do is they want to kind of convert some of the folks in the Twins clubhouse who maybe are not quite on board with that, to just show how those kind of statistics, particularly for pitching, things like spin rates, arm angles, stuff like that, a lot of the StatCast stuff, how that could be used to help you going forward. And I had a great conversation with Glenn Perkins about this, who, as you fellows know, is Mr. Analytics.
He's been on board since basically the outset.
Yeah, he was, and he went into great detail. I talked to him a little about this over the years, but he went into some great detail about how he made himself a better pitcher in 2015, it was, because he really paid attention to the spin rate on a slider and started experimenting with grips to try to make it spin even faster so it would get a bit more bite. Mm-hmm. And developed it to a point, and he made there was a game where he got Joey Votto to swing and miss at a pitch in the dirt. And to have a ball, and he made the excellent point, to have a ball move that much and fool a guy that good, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, he's the top on base guy every year. Like he swings, he's unbelievable.
I think everybody listening to this podcast who's a baseball fan, we probably don't need to give him any more. We don't need to pimp the guy because everybody knows he's good.
Exactly.
But I think that the point that Glenn was making is that he did, and Jack Goin was providing a lot of the information for him, who's the Twins' primary in-house analytics guy, and by taking advantage of all that was available, he was able to make himself a better pitcher. If you have other pitchers on your staff that are willing to do that, that's encouraging. Now, whether that's going to translate to a lot more victories this year, nobody knows, because this is still a game that's based on talent. You know, if you've got talent, you're going to win. And I still really am going to have to – I'm not sure there's enough talent here to do significantly better, but I'm willing to be wrong.
Now, my theory about this offseason, because I think a lot of fans, especially the casual fans that want to see multi-million-dollar deals handed out to big-time players to turn this around, I think the goal with Falvey and Levine was to surround what is an extremely young core. And I think what we saw between 2015 and 2016 with 83 wins and 59 wins with virtually identical rosters. There's some changes. Torrey Hunter is obviously a key difference, but Blaine Boyer's not a crippling loss, so to speak, was the fluidity or the unpredictability of young talent. When young talent takes a step back, everything can fall apart for you. I think what they wanted to do this offseason was surround these guys with mentally capable veterans. The Gimenez, the Jason Castro, Stanford-educated. You got the Yale-educated Breslow. These guys who... Gimenez has been in clubhouses that have won before also. So he also probably has some intellect as far as how guys carry themselves in the margins. You know, how you can steal games from the margins. I don't think many teams let games slip away like the Twins did last year. A 4-3 game turns to a 9-3 game with a couple a 3-run home run given up by a reliever.
I have never seen a team this bad, and I've covered some bad ones.
And I feel like these guys clean up the margins. You know, Craig Breslow, so intelligent guys who have experience, may not move the needle a ton in terms of talent. You know, Gimenez, he hits lefties. Castro doesn't do that, so he'll do some things that can help him. If Breslow is a lefty specialist, he's going to do probably more off the field than on it, but he's going to be helpful. And I feel like that was the goal, was, you know, Castro is going to revamp their pitching from the foundation. I think a great catcher is foundational, like Russell Martin was, first for the Pirates, for the Yankees before that, for the Dodgers before that. But now for the Blue Jays, he's helping them with a great foundation. I think Cervelli for the Pirates picked up where Martin left off. I think that was a good start. But I think what they're trying to find out is, let's equip the existing guys, the young and the very talented but raw, finding who they are players, the Rosarios, Sanos, Keplers. Let's equip them as best we can with what we can get to find out who they are. And then we can surround them with more talented players, if we need to go sign, and I say we as the Twins, if they need to go out and sign, you know, maybe a left fielder or something. I think they wanted to spend a year finding out how good Kyle Gibson is with a good catcher. And I feel like that actually makes a lot of sense to me. Instead of cleaning house, you know, they could have fired the entire staff. They could have flipped a bunch of Terry's guys that were on the 40-man roster that they didn't have any room for or any use for. I think they're taking a slow diplomatic approach. I think it's going to make a lot of sense when it all plays out.
I think that there's a lot of truth to what you say. I know that from talking to Levine and talking to Falvey, and Levine in particular. I mean, we talked at Twins Fest, and one thing, I'm writing about all this. The gist of what you've just said is what I'm going to be writing for Min Post this weekend.
Oh, good.
They did not, the way Levine explained it, is that they didn't want to come in and just bulldoze the whole operation and then in the process take out good people as well as people that probably didn't quite fit. Mm-hmm. I think what they've done is that they wanted to take – I mean, the Twins didn't get stupid overnight, you know. I think what they wanted to do, and they've talked about this, and some other folks have talked about this, is they wanted to take their time, take a good look at the organization, figure out what they did well, keep that, and then see how they could augment that with some of the analytic stuff and some of the other newer things. Look, it's no secret that the Twins fell behind baseball in innovation, in talent evaluation, and in all the things that pretty much every other team has done. But again, the Twins were good for a long time. It's not like the Cubs where they were lousy for 70 years, all right? Or the Pirates where they were lousy for 20 years. I think that there were some of the fundamental stuff started to slip late in that run of playoff appearances that they had in the aughts. And you could see it. You could see guys doing dumb things on the bases. You could see guys throwing the wrong cutoff man, all that kind of stuff. You could see in 08 and 09 and 2010. But they continued to win because generally they would play great for about a month. And they played in a lousy division. Mm-hmm. A division that seemed like every year the Tigers would find some way to blow it.
Right, they were their right, own, well, no, bullpen especially, they were their own worst enemy late in games.
Yeah, there were and they, you know, they went through a zillion, the Tigers went through a zillion closers, all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like at one point, I think three teams were outspending them, right, in that division other than maybe Kansas City, and they just seemed to get by on their smarts, and that kind of reversed.
They got so fat on Kansas City over those years, too. I mean, they dominated.
Right,
How much did hitting on Joe Mauer as the number one pick and also Santana in the Rule 5 allow them to paper over them falling behind?
Well, I think getting those guys, and let's not forget they got Justin Morneau as a third-round pick. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that went into it. And I think what happened is, I remember having a conversation with Carl Pavano about this very late in his tenure with the Twins. And as a guy who'd come up and had pitched in Miami and had pitched for the Yankees, had been through a couple of organizations that knew how to do this and generally were pretty good fundamentally.
Cleveland, too.
Yeah. He saw a couple of things, particularly with the infield play, that was not good. I remember talking to him about it one day. But again, because it was a division that was – you didn't have – at that time, you know, it wasn't like the American League East where you had the Yankees and the Red Sox in Toronto all banging heads with each other. It was a division that was very much up for grabs, probably the worst division – across the board, probably the worst division in baseball. Not that it was a lousy division, but the level of talent wasn't quite up to some other ones. So you were able to kind of just hang in there and then play well for about 6 weeks and then sneak in. I've been just very much hammering the Twins on the fundamental deficiencies going all the way back to 09 because you could see this coming. And then they went through this period where they weren't able to develop enough pitching. What we now have is an era where if you can't – because teams now carry 12 and 13 pitchers, if you can't develop your own pitching, it's so expensive to go get it.
Yep.
That you really can't compete unless you spend such a ridiculous amount of money on pitching. And it's just – you look at what they had to do to get Santana. You look at what – and they were unwilling to pay the market rates for relievers the last 4 or 5 years because mm-hmm. they were just – you know what it's like? It's like you're in a store with your grandfather, All right.
Yeah.
And he's going, I can't believe that you're paying $30 for jeans, for dungarees. And while they have a point, that's the going rate. You know, when the Twins came up $3 million light on a 2-year deal for Pat Neshek, that pretty much told you how they thought. And over the years, what we've discovered is that they don't produce enough pitching, and the pitching that they do produce, they end up turning almost all these guys into relievers. Because again, they were one of the last teams that realized that the whole trend of getting tall, hard throwing guys like a Kyle Gibson. Gibson is the prototype for what a lot of teams went to a lot earlier than the Twins did. There was still the whole pitch to contact stuff. Alex Wimmers is the classic example of how they thought as late as 2010. Well, he's got a great changeup. You can teach a guy a changeup, all right?
Johan Santana learned his from Bobby Cuellar.
That is correct, and turned him and won two Cy Young awards because of it. I'm kind of rambling here.
No, it's good because my theory is the Radke factory in Rochester went dry. Basically, they drafted Scott Baker. They drafted Nick Blackburn, or they acquired Nick Blackburn. They had all these guys cut from the same cloth.
That's right.
And then Garza kind of bucked the trend, but he was also a college pitcher. And the fact that he struck people out was kind of a bonus. And it was like, where do we find the next Radke? Everyone else is developing Johans, and you're looking for Radkes. Everyone else is driving Lamborghinis, and you're driving a Toyota
Everybody
Camry.
Else is developing Justin Verlanders.
I mean, there you go.
Santana was an anomaly because he was short, he was left-handed, and he threw hard. It's rare to find a left-handed pitcher that threw as hard as Santana. They're around, but particularly at his size. Most teams by that point were starting to sign and draft the really tall guys.
Verlanders and Prices, and the Twins are looking for Radkes. So
we're all on the same page with this. I think that a lot of to kind of bring this back to the whole analytics package. If there's a way to for guys to figure out how to figure out what your best pitch is. And throw it more often, and then improve the other ones you have based on spin rates, based on arm angles, and whatever. Now I think the Twins at least have all the tools that everybody else has. Now the question is, are these guys talented enough to pull this off? And if not, then you've got to go back to the drawing board. One other thing I was very critical of the Twins on the last draft, and I made this example with a lot of people. The Mets have traditionally been a pitching organization. The Twins have traditionally been a hitting organization, and that's fine. I mean, you could specialize in one or the other because you can always trade your excess to get more. But because we're now in an era where you need to fill out a 12 or 13 man pitching staff, you again have to develop your own. You can't necessarily trade to fill out all these slots. The Mets are a pitching organization, like I said. Their first four picks in the amateur draft last year were pitchers. And you can make the argument that, wait a minute, they've got a terrific starting staff.
They're about eight deep in guys who would be a number one for the Twins right now.
Well, what do they need more pitchers for? Well, the old axiom that you can never have enough pitching, that's what they believe in. That's what they continue to draft. The Twins decided to go another way. And to me, that's wrong. I mean, I'm not one of those people that believe they have a lot of pitching prospects in the organization because you've heard this for years, and these guys all flame out. Mm. And is it because they aren't – there could be a lot of reasons for it. It could just be that they're not good enough. It could be their instructions not good enough. That's something that Falvey and Levine are still trying to figure out. But at the very least, by allowing them to use all the analytical tools that are available, now these guys have a chance. If it turns out that they're not good enough, then that's a different deal. And then you proceed accordingly.
I think to backtrack just a little bit, I think too the stabs that Terry Ryan and company took into that part of the game blew up in their face. Shooter Hunt couldn't throw strikes. Carlos Gutierrez blew out his arm and was done. They dipped their toes in the water, didn't find it to their liking, and got back out and thought, you know what, we're going to do things the way we did forever. And I think the trouble too was the Metrodome line of thinking didn't have to follow them to Target Field. Didn't have to go down 4th Street and make a left turn. And in some ways, it kind of did. And then when they made their forays into spending more money, it wasn't necessarily on the things that it should. That they had that artificial ceiling above them kept them from spending foolishly. You know, who left the Twins that they really missed? You know, Corey Koski got hurt. His career didn't take off. Torrey Hunter was about the only one that really left and was still great, ended up coming back. But, you know, LaTroy Hawkins left. He was a fine player, but wasn't going to kill them. It was when they started losing out on, you know, Johan leaving that was the biggest issue. But that financial restraint that they had to show prevented them from overextending at times, too. And I feel like they just never really found that mix once they bumped the payroll up to $100 million, $112 million that first year, where it was like, okay, don't spend a ton of money on Carl Pavano, you know, $8, $9, $10 million per year. You know, you can find guys like that. Teams find guys like that off the scrap heap. Now, I like Pavano a lot, but he also had that unceremonious end to his career, and I think they waited a year too long to cut ties with him. And I felt like they never really turned the page on how to handle things at Target Field.
Well, I would disagree with you with one thing. Guys like Carl Pavano, who are serviceable starting pitchers, are harder to find than you think.
Sure.
And those are the guys that you have to develop in your own system because, again, if you go and get them from somebody else, A, you're overpaying because pitching is ridiculously expensive now, and you're essentially buying a time bomb because if you're that far along in your career, you're probably due for a Tommy John surgery or a blown shoulder. I mean, and that, which is another reason why you need to develop your own guys, because the way I like to talk about it is if you go and get a free agent pitcher, you're basically buying a car out of warranty.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sign a pitcher to a 4-year contract, as a lot of teams do, you're really basically paying for two good years and 2 years on a disabled list, because guys that are getting it. That are established enough to be free agents, I mean, they got a lot of miles on those arms. And again, if you want to manage your payroll, you want to keep your payroll reasonable, if you want to be able to pay, if you want to have top guys at every position, not just on your pitching staff, you need to be able to develop your own pitching. And we're kind of sounding like a broken record here, but it's true. And I think that that's what the Twins need to get to, is to develop enough of their own pitching so that if they need to go get a center fielder or they need to go get a catcher or they need to go get somebody else or they need to keep their own guys, I think they have a better opportunity to do that.
I think part of it is just veteran contracts are just not good. And you could look at it kind of on the David Price side.
Well, you pay for what they did, not what they're going to do.
Right. I mean, but Albert Pujols, I feel like Hamilton. I mean, think of all those kind of Angels contracts that they signed. And I guess if it's your own guy, you kind of talk about the car without a warranty. In some ways, you know what operations you've done, right? You know what issues you have with your car, I guess, if you want to use that analogy. And two, if you look at the extent of that player's time with your team, maybe you got so much value on the front end that some of that value you lose on the back end is kind of mitigated. Or Verlander for the Tigers or something like that.
So with your Pavano point, I actually really agree with that. I just think Pavano would be better suited to be a 4 or 5 instead of a 1 or 2.
Yeah,
I think
and on a championship team, he would be a 4 or 5.
Yeah, one of those guys, you might make a start in a long series, might be your long guy.
I'm not even talking about postseason. I'm talking about getting the postseason. On a good team, in his prime, he's a 4 or 5 guy.
I agree with that. And then, to your Mets point about having all those pitchers, I bet that entire rotation probably isn't making $30 million, even because of where they are in their arbitration and everything. That's the brilliance of it, is that if they can part it out quick enough. Now, the issues with Matz being injured, Harvey, Wheeler, all these guys have gone through different things.
Yeah.
But they've got guys like Gesselman, and I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, Seth Lugo. They've got all kinds of guys that can mix and match. The brilliance there is they've got 7 or 8 guys they can plug and play at any time and have one of the best rotations in the entire National League.
Again, because they develop their own pitch.
Right. Yeah. How many of those guys came from a different organization?
Off the top, I don't know off the top of my head. I'm going to presume that probably 1 or 2 did.
Wheeler was part of the Carlos Beltran trade from the Giants.
Okay.
I think that's the only one that doesn't register coming from that. So, I mean, that's the brilliance of developing your own pitchers. And so they're doing something that is also helping these guys transition through the system. I think the Twins may have lost their way in development too. I can't prove it. Everyone says, well, they're screwing up development, whether it's pitch to contact in the minors or something. Baseball's hard. Guys fall off the wagon all the time. They're just not good enough.
This is what Felvey and Levine are doing right now, though, right?
Right. I think they're going to have to look back and say, okay, where are we missing between double and triple A Is there something guys can do in terms of sequencing, in terms of rest, in terms of whatever the secret sauce of pitching is? I think there's a chance the Twins were also missing that somehow, that has kept, you know, Cole Stewart from striking people out in the minor leagues, might prevent Steven Gonsalves from reaching his potential previously. You know, those kind of things where guys like Alex Wimmers, you know, he battled injuries too, but maybe he would have missed out on something that would have made him as good a pitcher as he possibly could be.
Or maybe these guys just aren't that good.
It might be that they're picking bad apples to begin with.
The bus station is full of guys who were great in A-ball or Double-A.
Right.
And just were not able to make the next step. Now, it's also difficult to know what goes on in the minors because the Twins farm teams are so far afield. You know, you've got the A-ball team. A-ball teams are in Fort Myers and Cedar Rapids, and who gets to see them?
Right.
The Double-A team is in Chattanooga. Who gets to see that? The Triple-A team is in Rochester, New York. Again, unlike, say, the Red Sox, who have managed to cluster most of their farm teams all within a reasonable driving distance of Boston. Mm-hmm. You know, their Triple-A team is in Pawtucket, Rhode Island,
Salem,
which is about
an
island. I'll get them all.
No problem.
All right. The AAA team is in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, which is about an hour away. The AA team is in Portland, Maine, which is a couple of hours the other direction up 95. One of their A-ball teams, I think, is in Lowell. But the thing is that you've got your AA and AAA teams are all within driving distance of Boston. So their fans can go see, their scouts can go see. It's also a lot easier if you got a guy who needs to make a rehab start.
Sure.
You know, the Yankees have their AA team in Trenton, and all their pitchers that need to make a rehab start, they just get in the car, get on the Jersey Turnpike or the Garden State Parkway. I forget which way they go now. But they just go right down to Trenton a couple of hours, and they pitch, and they go home. And they buy a nice meal for the guys in the clubhouse, and then they go home. The Twins would be better served to have a team closer, but they're in a tough place because, the Midwest League where Cedar Rapids is, this area or even any place in the state would be a really, really long bus ride for most of those teams. And with the weather, you know, there's really no good option in Minnesota for them.
Right.
I think what's eventually going to happen is the Twins are eventually going to buy the St. Paul Saints.
I don't know
whether that ends up being a Triple-A team or a Double-A team. There's a lot of stuff that would have to happen. But I know that the Twins have the Twins are really eyeing that operation.
And it would be best for them to put them in Triple-A, right? Because then you could ship guys back and forth easy.
Well, I don't know. I'll add this. The Saints Stadium was built to Double-A specs. Capacity, clubhouse facilities, etc. Now, most AAA teams fly these days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that'd be a pretty easy stadium to expand. I think the minimum capacity in AAA is 10,000. It would be easy enough to expand that to 10,000. Most teams in AA is a bus league.
Mm-hmm.
That would be much harder too because there isn't a AA league anywhere close. I think that a Triple-A, if St. Paul eventually became a Triple-A team, I think that it would really thrive. I mean, they're drawing 8,000 for independent ball. I think folks that would love to see Triple-A prospects, particularly if the Twins get better.
Oh, yeah.
I think that'd be a huge drawing card. And remember, Pawtucket is 60 miles from Boston. And there are a lot of folks that go down there because they don't want to pay $100 for a ticket to Fenway Park,
mm-hmm.
$20 to park, you know, $9 for a hot dog, you know, all that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, and you could be in the PCL with the Iowa Cubs not far. You could have a nice rivalry there, too.
Would it change the, like, dynamic of the Saints, though? I mean, do they still do these, like, promotions and stuff in the minor leagues? They got it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You haven't been to a game lately?
No.
He's worried about
the Saints.
From the independents to the affiliated, would they still be able to do their pig in the shopping cart and everything?
Well, that's an excellent question. And my answer is I don't know.
I suspect they would probably be able to do most of it.
Well, you know, Major League Baseball is notoriously has a distinct lack of humor and almost a terminal seriousness. So it would be interesting to see whether or not, particularly if it's a Twins operation, whether how much of that stuff survives. But that's very much part of their DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you couldn't change that, I don't think.
I would like to think that they would leave that alone. But again, this is probably several years down the road.
Sure.
And there's a lot that would have to happen. I mean, the Twins would probably have to buy another AAA team and move it here and then incorporate the Saints into it. I don't have all the financial particulars of how it could happen, mm-hmm. but it would not be impossible.
No, Dave St. Peter has mentioned it at times that they've thought about it. He said it'd be difficult, but what's difficult when you've got money? I mean, you can make things happen, but you would have to find a city that isn't supporting its AAA team that you could move, and it'd be a lot of logistics.
And you would also have to have Mike Beck agree to do it.
Right.
Let's not forget that, you know, the Twins just can't magically wave a wand and get whatever they want.
Right. So you went to Fort Myers at actually kind of an interesting time.
Yeah.
Because you went when a lot of the there's not 60 guys in camp anymore, so you probably
saw. Right, it's only 40.
Yeah. I mean, it's still plenty, and they're making cuts kind of one, two at a time.
They made a couple today.
Today, Buddy Beauchesne and Tommy Field, utility infielder and left-handed reliever, getting sent out.
I saw Beauchesne's pitch. He was not good.
I like Buddy, but at the same time, not make or break. Pretty superfluous if he and Ryan O'Rourke are healthy at the same time as far as lefty one-out guys. But you did go at a time when you can probably see more of the big leaguers, which is good.
Yeah.
When you take the temperature of this club, what do you come away feeling? I mean, did you feel like it's a confident team, a team that should be better than last year? What was your final assessment as you hopped on the plane last night?
I think folks in the clubhouse believe that they can't possibly be as bad as they were last year. What that's going to look like, I don't know, and I don't think they know. But I think that they kind of look around a clubhouse and just say, there's too much talent in here for us to lose 103
Levine
games.
Said that at his introductory press conference. And I actually, you know, people on Twitter, oh, yeah, he's got to say that. I believe him. I think
well,
right.
He does have to say that, but he better believe it or else what's the point of even going out and playing a season?
Well, your first presser, you probably shouldn't be lying. Unless you want to get good at it, I guess. You got to practice makes perfect.
I think you also have to be realistic. I mean, pretty much every bad thing that could have happened to this team happened last year. I mean, mm-hmm. Gibson was awful. Hughes was awful before he got hurt.
They fired the guy that had worked there for 30-some-odd years, Terry Ryan. I mean, I thought he had a lifetime contract. I really did.
So did he.
I thought he had the pole ads. Yeah, he probably did, yeah. And I say that with a straight face because Terry's my favorite man in the game, treated the media very well. I thought he was going to be here until the day he decided to walk away. I didn't think he'd work for another team. Now he's with the Phillies.
I saw him three times in spring training, too. And it's very weird to see him in a Phillies golf shirt.
Now he's working for McPhail, right? So there's a Twins connection
then,
there, but yeah.
Yeah, there is some familiarity in that organization at a couple levels. I can't remember off the top of my head any of the other ones. But yeah, there's a number of levels that it made sense for him to make that move. He succeeded McPhail. But yeah,
That's how people get jobs. You know, it's all networking. It's no different than any other business. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're suddenly cast adrift, your friends take care of you. But the other thing is that Terry is – I was just talking to a couple of scouts last night at dinner. Terry is – I don't know whether I've come across anyone in baseball who is as respected as Terry Ryan. It's unfortunate that this happened, and I think that Terry has been very classy through all of this. I mean, I've known plenty of people in baseball who even off the record would rip their former team.
Mm-hmm.
Not him. You know, you know he's got to be upset. You know he's still got to be angry. You know he's still got to be bitter. There's a lot of stuff that happened that I'm sure we'll never hear about because Terry Ryan will not tell somebody like me
mm-hmm.
or somebody like Lavelle or somebody like Mike Verdino.
Right.
It's just not going to happen because he has too much class. But it's I mean, to get back to your question, I mean, guys look around a clubhouse. Breslow talked about it too. He said, we've got too much talent to be this bad. Words to that effect.
He's played on some really good teams.
Yeah,
I mean, he knows what talent looks like.
Yeah, you know, and he's. The question is, let me backtrack a second. One thing that I found really interesting in my time down there is that generally at this time of the spring, all the fundamental stuff, all the defensive situational stuff, that stuff's all done. Guys are just taking batting practice. They're you know, playing the games. They're doing whatever. I mean, but as late as Friday, the Twins spent an hour before a night game working on different defensive situations, including one that I had never seen before. And I don't know how many of the folks that listen to this know my background, and maybe we should.
We will. We'll delve on that after this.
Yeah. They were doing a situational drill where with left-hand batter up in a shift, so the third baseman's on the right side, they were using a pitching machine to throw up, to fire up pop-ups to the pitchers, so the pitchers were running to the third baseline to run down pop-ups. I have never seen that before in any camp. Now, that doesn't mean it's never been done. It's just unusual, and certainly from folks that I talked to, the Twins have never done a drill like that. And part of that is Molitor, who, as you might imagine, is terminally disgusted with all the nonsense that he had to watch last year.
You can see it on his face. Yeah. I mean, I think he aged some last year in that he had to watch them play. It's just disappointing to see that happen.
I think that if they had ever dusted Sano's neck for fingerprints, they would have found Molitor's one day.
I totally agree.
Yeah. So he's making absolutely certain to do everything that he can do to eliminate a lot of the stupidity that we saw on a daily basis. So I thought that that was interesting. This guy, Jeff Pickler, the new outfield coach, I watched him do a bunch of different drills with guys that I have not seen an outfield coach anywhere do before. Most of the teams that I've covered, going back to the Expos and the Braves in spring training in the 80s, to the Red Sox in the late 80s to 90s that I covered in Boston, to the Yankees in the 90s and early 2000s, to the Mets in 1999 and 2000, to these Twins, I have never seen an outfield coach do more than just hit fungo fly balls to guys. He was doing drills where guys were trying to pick up balls on the move, hitting balls over guys' heads. You know, I would occasionally see a guy, in particularly situations where there was like a tricky wall or something, just hit balls off the wall. But the skill specific drills that these guys were doing to replicate stuff that actually happened during games, I'd never seen an outfield coach do before, and I thought it was fascinating. And I'd like to think it's going to make these guys more prepared. I mean, a lot of the really stupid stuff that we saw last year, I'd like to think that you'll see less of that. So the point being that these guys are going above and beyond what to try to fix a lot of the nonsense that we saw last year, which I thought was intriguing.
I thought it was brilliant to bring in someone from the Dodgers organization. Again, I also like to look at things a little bit off the beaten path, and that the Dodgers are an emulatable organization. You can't spend like they do, but they also do things on the field very, very well. And I think getting a guy from that mix, who I think came handpicked from Josh Burns and that kind of tree, from, I want to say he was there after Arizona, after being the GM. He came with good recommendations. And James Rowson from organizations like the Yankees and Cubs, who had hit under his tutelage. You know, he had worked with some of the really great Cubs hitters. I just felt like when they cast a wide net this offseason to give the support staff for Paul Molitor a boost, I think they did a very nice job.
Yeah, sometimes you need to bring in people from other organizations that have done it well. And keep in mind, the Dodgers have been known for fundamentals going all the way back to Branch Rickey in the 1940s.
Okay, that's quite a lineage.
Yeah, and folks who spent time in Dodger Town, and I did towards the end of the time when Dodger Town was their training site, they used to have all these different stations, sliding pits, strings to set up for strike zones. They were one of them and the Cardinals were the first organizations to really, really drill down and do a lot of the specific stuff to develop individual skills. And the Dodgers continued to do that all the way through their time in Dodger Town. So that's one of the reasons why they've always been such a good fundamental organization and why they've won so much.
So let's hit the rewind button. We were going to talk about your path to this point. Obviously, everyone has to choose journalism, or maybe journalism chooses you. You know, I know for me, I grew up as someone who could just write. I write like I talk, which is unfortunate in some respects, but in others it works.
That's where editors come in.
There you go. But some people, like, they're very brilliant speakers, but they just don't write like that. It always confuses me how that doesn't work. But as far as, you know, becoming a writer, choosing sports, getting into baseball, and then your path that brought you here, because obviously you're not Minnesotan from the roots.
How can you tell?
I read your Twitter bio. No, I'm kidding. I just don't want to say anything inflammatory.
I'll be happy to give people my background. It's fine.
People have fascinating backstories to get to where they're going, and I think yours is going to be no exception.
Well, I'll try to make this as brief and informative as I can.
Well, let's go for it.
You know, I was I grew up on Long Island, as if the accent wasn't a dead giveaway. I studied journalism at Fordham University in the Bronx, which is kind of a cradle of communications people. They've Vin Scully is a Fordham grad. Uh-huh. We've sent dozens of writers and broadcasters into the field. Bob Papa, who is the Giants play-by-play guy, is a Fordham guy. Malcolm Moran, who was my mentor at Fordham, he was 4 years ahead of me. Malcolm is a guy who wrote for the New York Times, for USA Today, and is probably one of the most respected college basketball writers of the 20th and 21st centuries. He now runs the journalism program at Indiana University. I was fortunate enough to work part-time at Newsday with some really, really great people. I went to the Miami Herald, and I worked 8 years for them as a mainly covering high schools in bureaus. I never worked in the main office. I was a bureau guy for 8 years, but I also got at the very end. I was always a baseball guy because my dad was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. I could tell you a million Brooklyn Dodger stories that he has, but we'll run out of time. I can tell you that I got my passion from baseball from watching Met games with my father.
Did he transition from Dodgers to Mets when the Dodgers left?
He did.
And was that difficult?
Yes.
I suspect so.
Unlike almost any Dodger fan that I ran into from Brooklyn, he continued to follow the Dodgers even though they were in Los Angeles, because he said, they're my team. Mm-hmm. So loyalty is also very big in my family, as you might imagine. So when I got to cover spring training baseball, the Expos and the Braves, it was a thrill. And then I got a job at the Portland, Maine Press Herald, which was probably the best job I've ever had. I was stationed in Boston, and I covered all four of the Boston Pro teams for them. That was back at a time when newspapers had a bit of money to spend. And so that was quite an education. So I was around the Red Sox with Roger Clemens. Wow. And Jim Rice at the end of his career, and Wade Boggs and guys like that. So it was quite an education to cover a team that really hated the media as much as they did. And they did, because it was still before the Red Sox started winning world championships. And there was very much a the fans had a love-hate relationship with the team, because they were so frustrated because these guys couldn't figure out how to win a World Series. And it had been so long. And so I did that for 8 years, which, again, was quite educational. And I covered the Celtics also when Bird, McHale, and Parrish were finishing up.
Jeez.
So,
wow.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of stuff for a young guy to learn. And then I went from there. I got a job with the Newark Star-Ledger covering the Yankees. And my first year on the Yankees was 1996, which was Joe Torre's first year, mm-hmm. Bob Watson's first year as a general manager, and the first world championship that they won in that stretch.
That's where that picture of you and John Heyman and a bunch of those other writers surfaced. Was it towards the end of last year for a 20-year?
It was a couple of weeks ago, actually.
Oh, was it more recent than that?
Yeah, it was my buddy Jack Curry, who had covered, who was another Fordham guy.
Is he with the Yes Network?
Yes, he is. Okay. And at the time, he was the Yankee beat writer for the New York Times. In fact, this was really interesting. When I started on, maybe it's only interesting to me, but I'm going to tell you anyway. when I started on the Yankees in 96, there were 8 newspaper beat guys who traveled with the team.
Oh, my
four
God.
Four of them were Fordham grads.
Really?
Wow.
It was phenomenal.
But why is that school in particular, do you think?
Well, because it's a very... two newspapers on campus and a radio station that employed students. And there's a very high level of excellence that's demanded. And, you know, we just produce good people. The one thing that I have, people aren't going to like this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The difference between us and the guys that go to Syracuse and the guys that go to Northwestern and the guys that go to Missouri, we don't stand on a soapbox bragging about ourselves. Right?
You hear about it with those schools.
Yeah, we just go out and we just do good work and let that stand on its own.
What about USC guys? We should incriminate you a little further. I'm sure maybe we can get Rhett Bollinger to listen. Just keep that in mind.
Oh, God.
Well, I actually don't know. Is Rhett an SC guy?
Yeah.
I don't know very many. I didn't come across. Most of those guys are on the West Coast. I didn't really come across a lot of them. I certainly didn't come across enough to think they had an attitude. So
good.
But anyway, I then spent 6 years, 2 years on the Yankees, 1 year on the Mets, and then I covered the Olympics, which is how I met my future wife, Rachel Blount from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. So we met at the Olympics in Nagano in 1998, and I covered another Olympics in Sydney in 2000.
Was she from here?
Oh, yeah.
She
had joined Jay Weiner as the second Olympics person at the Star Tribune in 1998. And so that's how we met, and we liked each other, and we did a long-distance thing for a while. And then it came to 2001, 2002, and we had a decision to make. We wanted to get married, and we wanted to make a life of it. And then it was, okay, how are we going to do this? Where are we going to go? And long story short, I thought it was best for the both of us that she keep her job in a union shop where she owned a house, where they loved her, where she did great work. You know, in our business, it's very rare to find somebody who has a job that they like, where their bosses treat them well. To ask her to quit her job and come to New York and maybe get herself in a situation that wasn't quite as good as this one seemed unfair. So I quit my job, and I came here hoping that at some point one of the two newspapers here would hire me full-time. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. But I did managed to hook on with the New York Times to do a lot of freelance stuff. My buddy Jack Curry was the spearhead of that. He suggested that I write a twin story for them, and they liked it, and that led to a lot of work that I've now gotten since then. And I picked up other clients. You can read my stuff in a lot of places. MinPost is my primary local client, but I've also done stuff for Minnesota Monthly and for the University of Minnesota Alumni Magazine. So it's been nice, and I've been able to continue to cover baseball. I was for 3 years. I was the chairman of the local baseball writers chapter, which is something I never got to do in New York, which was great. And I've been involved with the Diamond Awards dinner since its inception, something I also never really got a chance to do in New York. So it's all been good. And so when I talk about baseball, I'm not going to claim that I'm that much smarter than people, but I think that I bring a lot more experience and a lot more maybe savvy than a lot of folks, and I'm not always right. I can be spectacularly wrong, but I've seen quite a bit, and I use that experience to try to color my opinions and my projections about the Twins, you know, based on what I've seen. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, having covered a last place Red Sox team in, what was it, 92, I think it was, 92 or 93, that was a veteran team that had just bottomed out.
I think it's back when they chased Kirby Puckett, that offseason, 92 to 93.
Yeah, they...
They and the Phillies chased Kirby.
Yeah, that was interesting, too. They made some... They went after some interesting people. Because they knew that they were bad and they needed to get better fast. And what they ended up doing is they ended up getting some good people out of their farm system, Mo Vaughn and Phil Plantier, who had a much better career than Phil, but they were able to come through and then eventually Nomar, Garcia Parra, and then they were the anchors of the better teams that they had in the mid 90s. And then of course they get Pedro.
It was unbelievable, those 98, 99.
Yeah, and they were on their way.
A couple of questions about your stops. You said you were at New York Newsday, right? Or was it Newsweek?
No, the Newark Star-Ledger in New Jersey.
Oh, gotcha. Because I was going to say that's Verducci. And you were in Miami? Miami Herald?
I was at the Miami Herald, yeah. I was a part-timer at Newsday when I was in college, when I was at Fordham, and Verducci wasn't there yet.
Okay. Because, yeah, I do wonder about these places that concentrate talent. I've asked multiple people at the Kansas City Star.
They are stockpiled.
Yeah, I mean, Whitlock and Poznanski and all those. Yeah.
Well, and the guys that they have there now. I mean, yeah. Sam Mellinger and Rustin Dodd.
Andy McCullough
is a guy who had also come from the Ledger. I know Andy.
He's a Syracuse guy, though, I think.
Andy, he's a good Syracuse guy, though.
He's incredible. He's one of the best.
Well, you know why? Because he doesn't lord it over you. He doesn't brag on you. He doesn't wear it on his sleeve. You know, I went to, you know, Andy's another guy that just keeps his mouth shut and does good work.
He might be one of the best beat reporters in the entire MLB.
If there's a guy that writes a better game story than Andy McCullough, I haven't read him.
Right.
Wow.
Andy would be embarrassed if you heard me say this.
I think he's incredible. Let's see if I got it here. Okay, so how was your transition to Minnesota? Obviously moving westward. Was it smooth? Did it take
a while? I was ready for a change. I mean, I tell people this all the time that, you know, I used to live in Fort Lee about a mile from the George Washington Bridge. And in the time that it took me to leave my house, stop at the deli, get the papers, and get on the bridge, I was already annoyed. Because somebody would have done something stupid. You get cut off, you know. And that's kind of a way of life in New York, is that you walk around with just this kind of edge. You know, you're waiting for somebody to make you mad, and it invariably happens. And then, and I just thought, do I really want to be agitated all the time? You know, so I was ready for this. I was ready to, the first couple of months I was here, you know, I was lucky in that I was able to get a temp job with the Star Tribune in their digital department. But for about a month and a half, I was basically had no job for the first time in my life. I had nothing. So I was riding my bike and just kind of enjoying the area and just unwinding and recharging. And it was just delightful.
So what do these papers, you talked about Fordham and the production of journalists, what do the ones that you see a lot of, you know, these very popular writers come out of, or even if they have a current staff that's amazing. Is that simply an editor in your mind? Is it culture that they have there?
It's the culture. Because at Fordham, the newspaper was the Ram. And we didn't have an advisor. We were basically on our own completely. Huh. But we also had a series of editors, students, older guys, who showed you the way. We showed you a right and wrong way to do it. And when I was a freshman, the sports editor was a guy named Tom Canavan, who has been the longtime AP guy out of New Jersey. When I was a sophomore, the sports editor was Ernie Palladino, who worked forever for Gannett Westchester and was their Giants writer for a long time. I was the sports editor my junior year, and as a senior, I was the executive editor, and the editor-in-chief was Jim Dwyer, who's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, who writes for the New York – he's a columnist for the New York Times.
Jeez.
You would have to be a complete idiot to not learn anything from these people. And I was also very fortunate that I've worked in offices with folks who have won Pulitzer Prizes for both writing and for photography. And I'm not saying this to toot my own horn. I'm saying this because when you're around talented, highly motivated people, it forces you to be better. It forces you to really closely examine your own work and say, am I good enough? And it also gives you the confidence that when you run across an editor in a profession, and I've had a few of these, who would tell you weren't good enough, the first thing that you have to do is this person right? And if they are, how do I make myself better? Now, sometimes they were wrong. Sometimes they were just not very good themselves. But some of them were absolutely on point. And it just you read other people, you see how other people do things, and it raises your own level to a point where hopefully you're good enough to kind of hang in that world. And I think that being around so many good people has just been a just been a godsend for me.
So it's kind of a jack of all trades. When your phone rings or you get an email, you know, buzzes in your pocket and someone's asking you to do an assignment, what are the ones that you like the most? You know, if you like going out on you know, obviously you're in Milwaukee to cover the, was it the round of 64 or the 32?
Yeah, the first and second rounds of the NCAA basketball tournament.
What is the thing that you kind of get a little extra skip in your step when you're like, yeah, I'm going to cover this? I mean, do you still have that?
I love covering the NCAA tournament. I love covering baseball.
Do you do just men's or do you do women's too?
I haven't done the women's in a while, but I have done it.
Can anybody beat UConn? I just don't see it.
Not this year.
No, they're unbelievable. Anyway, sorry to sidetrack.
No, that's all right.
They're absolutely incredible. And that clip that came out of Gino Auriemma last week talking about how body language, and he'll bench Breanna Stewart if she's showing bad body language. He'll play whoever is rowing the boat, basically, I guess, to steal a colloquialism locally. But he'll bench anybody that's not doing their part. You know, as far as reveling in the success of their teammates.
He is so – I've seen the HBO did a special on them, and he is way more intense than I thought he'd be. I thought someone with that many accolades –
He's a Paisan from Philly. How could you think he's not intense?
I thought eventually when you have all this talent and all this winning, you kind of eventually like, okay, you know, things are good.
He's definitely not on autopilot.
Yeah, right.
You know, I think that coaches of very, very good, highly motivated teams – don't get the credit they deserve. A guy like Gino, who has produced phenomenal teams for a long period of time, they simply think, oh, it's easy. You just get the best talent. You roll out the balls. You sit back there and you give good quotes to the press and it's all cool. Well, it takes a lot, and I would use Brad Frost locally as an example. I mean, Brad can pretty much get any player he wants at this point, you know. And for those who don't know, Brad is the coach of the women's hockey coach at the University of Minnesota. They've gone to six consecutive Frozen Fours. Before this year, they had won four of the last five national championships. And the year that they lost, they got beat in the championship game. There's the coaches that can get the best out of who get highly talented players to play together as a team. And it's a little easier to do among the women because you've got women, for whatever reason, and I've had women coaches tell me this a lot, that there's more of that kinship among women athletes, particularly the highly motivated ones. Look at the Lynx, for instance. Sure. I cover them a lot.
Yeah.
There seems to be a lot more there's less of the, you know, selfish me stuff. And a lot more of the we're all in this together that you really need to succeed as a team. And Gino is a master at getting highly talented people to buy into the team concept, do whatever they have to do to win. And there's a reason why so many of them are so good when they go on to the WNBA. I think that that's a real underappreciated talent in a coach something that's – Gino might be one of the two or three best college basketball coaches of all time. I think you look at him, you look at John Wooden, and feel free to pick who the third one is. Dean Smith, you know, throw
in. Is Coach K in that mix for you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, yeah, I think he has.
Absolutely,
been.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that's another thing. I mean, Krzyzewski, I mean, there are a lot of people that don't like Duke and, you know, the whole. You know, we are Duke and all that nonsense. But, you know, there's appreciate what the guy's done.
For sure.
There are a lot of coaches with similar talent that don't win as often, and they graduate their kids. You know, Duke's not an easy school to get into.
No.
You know, and I think there guys like that, they think they're better than everybody else. Well, maybe because they are.
I think what amazes me most is that it's amateur talent that has won. I think it's 111 games in a row without a hiccup. Like they did have a, I think it was a 2-point win over Tulane maybe this year. Somebody in the AAC. They've never lost an AAC game, but to not have that hiccup with that with 18, 19, 20, and 21 year old athletes who are prone to have off days. You know, these aren't finely tuned professional athletes that do things for a job. You know. There's so many upsets in March Madness because young players can have off days.
And they play so many games.
Right, yeah. And just the repetition. That speaks to another level, too, of how well they're maintained or they're treated or how they're conditioned both mentally and physically, to play the game by Oriema, and I think that's a feather in his cap.
I'm old enough to remember when UCLA on the men's side won, what was it, 111 games in a row. And that was a phenomenal achievement. I mean, they would play for the NCAA title every year. And until the David Thompson team beat them in the semifinals of whatever year that was, 73, I think it was, or 74. Until then, they were a machine. And the fact that they had, you know, they would change players, you know, because it's college. You know, you can't keep the same eight guys for 10 years. And the fact that they continued to get good players and they had dominant players and guys, not just – you know, not just Lou Alcindor, as he was known then, not just Bill Walton, but they had all the complementary players who were so good and so smart and bought into the whole team concept. It was just amazing to see.
As a veteran writer, we've been through your background here. Was it difficult adjusting to the internet age? And kind of how do you see journalism changing, and in what ways has it stayed the same?
Well, I think that where it's changed is the speed. If something happens on a spring training game, everybody's got it on Twitter within a few minutes. I think you can, if you monitor Twitter a lot, it's harder to, if somebody breaks a story, the way it used to be, if somebody brought, God, when I covered the Yankees, I would go to the deli every day to buy the News, the Times, and the Post, and I would be petrified that even if I broke something, that there would be something in one of those papers that I didn't have. And often there was. But now it's harder to do that because with the websites if somebody breaks a story, it's online at 8 o'clock at night. And then everybody is following up within an hour, and it's very difficult. I mean, and most places are good about crediting whoever broke the story first. Having a smartphone is great because it also used to be, before we had any of those, that if you were on the road, particularly covering the Yankees, when George Steinbrenner was liable to do or say anything, you felt like you were trapped in your hotel room. Because the way it worked with Steinbrenner is that you got in the habit of calling him in the morning. The way it worked is that you would call and leave a message with the receptionist at about, I don't know, 9 o'clock in the morning. And then at about between 11:30 and 12:30, he'd return all the calls, if he felt like talking. And if you were on his good side on a particular part of the season, he would call you back. But if you weren't there when he returned the call and then you called him back again, you were out of luck. So you had to wait for that call. So you were held hostage in your own hotel room waiting for George to call you back. And there were many days I can remember, one weekend series, I'm in Seattle, I'm looking out the window, it's a beautiful day, I can see down to the, you know, down to the market, and I'm thinking, oh man, I'd love to go out and get a big bowl of clam chowder, but I can't leave because I got to be here when Steinbrenner returns the call. Now, I got a smartphone. You know, if he was still alive,
and he returned it. Call now.
Yeah, and you know, and whatever. But no matter who you're getting calls back from or texts, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you don't necessarily have to get a voice call from somebody now. So it's changed. Where it's the same is it still requires good reporting. It still requires working sources. It still requires having people trust you. It still requires using your eyes. I mean, sometimes you can spot stuff. Everybody thinks that, oh, you know, the guys leak stuff to certain guys. Well, sometimes what happens is you see stuff in front of you that you think is interesting or weird, and then you go and ask somebody a question about it, and then they tell you a piece of information that puts it in context, and that's when you break a story.
And that was last year. I had doubt about that kind of thing. I saw when all the pitchers were out one day, I saw Trevor May back in the back, and I thought, something's not right here. So I went over to Rhett, because I trust Rhett, and we're about the same age, and you know, hey, is this something weird? He's like, oh, no, it's no big deal. Then that was the beginning of the back issues, and it was like, okay, well, I could have gotten out in front of that if I would have just asked questions. And sometimes,
well, if you'd asked the right guy.
Yeah, so, and sometimes you don't trust your intuition or you don't want to rock the boat. And so part of that, too, is like part of the job is not being the guy that everyone enjoys talking to, but rather finding the truth. And it's a hard balance for me, especially as someone, you know, I'm not a card-carrying BBWAA member. I'm sometimes sense I'm more year to year with the team, and so I have to kind of be diplomatic at the same time as doing my job, and it's like, ah, I could have had that, you know, and that, so that's frustrating for someone like me.
Well, I would say trust your instinct. And when you see something that doesn't make sense, you should have developed a relationship with somebody in the organization who can actually answer the question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Going to another writer is not helpful in a situation like that.
Probably accurate.
Because if a writer has that contact, they're not sharing it with you.
Right.
If you had come to me and asked me that question and I had spoken to someone in the organization and had gotten the answer that was eventually out there, I would not have shared that with you.
Understood.
And you wouldn't, and you shouldn't expect me to.
Right.
I can tell you this. There was I was down at spring training a few years ago, and this is a great example of just using your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I was standing outside the clubhouse talking to someone, and I don't want to out this person by saying who it was because you'll figure out why in a second. And there had been a lineup posted in the clubhouse. This is when Justin Morneau was going through his concussion issues. There was going to be a B game on a backfield. And some of the lineup guys were playing in it because the team was going down the road someplace. And you know, I know Delman Young was in a lineup, and I think Dozier was in a lineup. And suddenly a whole line of guys go by me in dress whites, as in they're going to play, and one of them was Morneau. And the guy I was talking to goes to me, you know he's playing today, right? As in, this was going to be the first spring training game that Justin Morneau was going to play after missing the entire last season with last season with a concussion. Well, and what they were doing is they were keeping quiet about it because they didn't want, as if 3,000 people were going to go to a backfield to watch a B game, but they didn't want anybody to know. They didn't want any attention. So I went to someone in the organization who I trusted, and I said, is he playing today? And he said, oh, yeah. So I was able to get that out. I didn't have a Twitter account at the time, but I was working for MinPost, and MinPost did have a Twitter account. So I was able to get that out there, and probably about a half an hour ahead of the time that the Twins announced, or where they spread word through the press box, that maybe you guys might want to come out and watch the B game. But that's simply an example of seeing, of being in the right place, seeing something, and have people who trust you.
Yeah.
And that's simply based on relationships that I had established over a period of time. That's the best example I can give you. When I say when you use your eyes, that's what I mean.
I think that's great advice. Okay, so before we let you go, are you cool with me going over the opening day roster and we'll kind of bounce thoughts off?
Yeah, sure. Let's figure it out.
I did my last projection for zone coverage yesterday. I've done three. Some things have changed. I thought Ryan Vogelsong would make the team. Again,
It's a hard thing to do when you're here and they're there and you can't really see it. I mean, that's one reason why I wanted to go down and kind of eyeball these guys myself, just to get a better – not just because it's hard to tell, but you know, I also wanted to just kind of like take everybody's temperature and talk to the Falvey and to Levine after they'd seen guys and just kind of get a better sense of what's going on.
I think I'm a little conditioned to the idea that Vogelsong might have been more apt to make the team under Terry Ryan. Again, not saying Terry Ryan had a way of doing things that I would incriminate him with, but they did like to have those veterans in there, and I think Vogelsong kind of fit the bill with the
Breslows.
Well,
but you know, they brought in several of these guys, and you don't have to keep them all.
Right. You know, it's a good point, and I was a little surprised that they let him go when they did. I know he asked about and asked for his release, but he did have a later opt-out, and a lot of teams now, 3/28 is kind of the day, which is today, of letting these guys go. They gave him a little bit of a jump so he could find another job elsewhere, which incidentally hasn't happened yet.
A lot of teams do that. I mean, a lot of veterans are savvy enough to have that conversation early mm-hmm. enough. The last thing you want to do if you're a veteran guy or a non-roster guy in camp, the last thing you want to do is get cut 2 days before the end of spring training.
When 40 man's are full.
Because then you're, yeah, exactly.
So that's how it's evolved a little bit. There's been some injuries too, so we'll cover that as well.
Yeah.
I think the lineup is pretty ironclad. Castro at catcher, Maurer at first, Dozier second, Sano third, Polanco at short. My regular starting outfield, I've got Rosario, Buxton, Kepler, and then I got Byung-ho Park at DH. Anything that jumps out at you that you might see differently?
That all seems reasonable. You know, I I think the only Polanco seems to be getting most of the work at shortstop. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't have the greatest arm in the world, but you know, they seem to be okay with that. I think you know, Vargas fouling the ball. I was there tonight that Vargas fouled the ball off his foot, and it looked bad.
Yeah,
he was standing there on one leg like a flamingo. He was in such pain, and I hope I'm wrong about this, but they only took X-rays. Maybe they were. Maybe they've done an MRI by now, and they haven't told anybody. Mm-hmm. But you got to be real careful with those, because if he's got a hairline fracture in that foot, particularly with a big guy like that, and he tries to play on it, you can really make it worse, and then he's out for a while.
Well, and then you ruin – this is last option year. The Twins petitioned for a fourth option year.
Yeah.
If that year's a loss, there's no way for him to be a change of scenery candidate. He doesn't build any value. It's bad for him.
Yeah.
It's bad for the team as well. The one curveball I do see is if they did have Grossman as the primary DH because Park's not on the 40 – I don't see Grossman as a DH. He doesn't have enough pop, but
he's a backup guy.
Yeah, he really is.
He's a backup guy.
And you know, if they wanted to be a little careful with the 40 to start the year, I'm not saying I see that, but that's the only thing, because then JB Shuck could maybe make the bench as the fourth outfielder. But I think they want Robbie as the fourth. It helps that Buxton, Kepler, and Rosario, all their starting outfielders, can play center, meaning that they're never going to ask Grossman to play center. He couldn't really play left very well last year.
And they, you know, you can throw Danny Santana out there, too.
Yeah, and that's on my bench right now. I've got Jimenez, Escobar, Danny Santana, and Robbie Grossman. I have crossed out A-Ray Adrianza, probably going on the disabled list with the oblique thing.
Yeah, I was there tonight. He got hurt. It didn't look good. Those things take a while.
And I thought he made a lot of sense in that if they're going with Polanco at short or Escobar as the primary backup, you want a guy who can pick up the ball in the eighth and ninth inning in close games at short. Adrianza's that guy. Incidentally, Kinsler, if he's your closer, and I think he'll start the year that way.
Yeah, I think so too.
Is a ground ball guy. So you're going to want someone that picks up the ball in the ninth inning. They do have some relievers that throw grounders or induce grounders, so it might have made sense to have him on the team. Santana as a 25th man is defensible to me. He can play all over, not particularly well.
Yeah, and he's out of options, right?
Right, yeah. So that's the other thing, too, is, you know, it might be only a temporary stay until the Twins move on from him.
I mean, the guy can play six positions.
And he's 26. And, you know, he's not finished product.
And, you know, most teams, because you keep so many pitchers now, you need probably have one guy on your bench that can play six positions.
Yeah.
You know, all three outfield positions and then three in the infield.
Your Chris Coughlins, your Ben Zobrists. Not that those are the same kind of player, but somebody who can do that.
Similar guys, yeah. Yeah.
Any gripes with that bench? I don't think John Ryan Murphy is obviously going to be the backup catcher.
No, I think I think it's pretty obvious to me that Jimenez is going to be the backup guy.
Yep.
I think it'll be interesting to see how they – I don't remember how many spots they have on the 40.
They cleared one with May to the 60 to activate Breslow.
Okay, because you know they're probably going to put Perkins on the 60, on the 60-day DL. Yep. That'll open up another spot, because it looks like to me that they're going to have to create at least two spots.
I think two from now and three total after having added Breslow, because you have to add Park and then you'd have to add –
Breslow's already on.
Right. So you have to have Jimenez and Park, right?
Yeah.
So with that said, we'll have to take somebody off that is on either due to not making the team or because
they stink.
Yeah, and we'll get to that as we get into the pitching staff.
Yeah.
So I think the five-man staff is pretty ironclad. Irvin Santana taking the ball against Danny Duffy. The order is not specific. I have Santana, Gibson, Santiago, Hughes, and Duffy as my 1-5.
Yeah, I think Duffy's probably done enough to be the fifth guy. You know, because the other thing is that they don't need a fifth starter right off the bat. They only really need one for the second turn through the rotation.
I think it was the 13th was the first day in my mind that something like that was the first time they'd really need one based on built-in off days.
Yeah, Tom, you got a schedule in front of you?
Let me pull one up.
Yeah.
So he could work as a swing man to get a couple innings in if
I can't remember whether he's got options or not.
Yeah, you can option him out.
Yeah, because then you got a couple of ways to play it. I mean, you can have him do that. You could send him to AAA to get a start in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of different ways you can, and then keep an extra bullpen guy. There's a lot of ways you can manipulate it. But I think it seems to me that you know, Jimenez has played for both Texas and Cleveland, so he's played for Falvey and Levine. He's here for, you know, they didn't bring him in here to cut him. No. You know, he's here for a reason. And I'm wondering what Murphy's future is in the organization too, because mm-hmm. I mean, certainly they you know, they gave up a major league player to get him.
Hicks is having a big spring too. I mean, we've said this before. let's just say that I have a rubber stamp that says Aaron Hicks has had a big spring.
Yeah, he's done fine. Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether he ends up being, because it was him and
Aaron Judge.
One of those guys is going to be the primary right fielder. Judge has had a nice spring too.
Yep. Between him and Greg Bird, they've got some really exciting young players.
Yeah, you know, I was there the day, because I filled it on the Yankees for 2 days, and I was there the day Bird hit the two home runs.
He's a monster. I think somebody had posted a picture of him next to Dellin Betances, and he made Betances look a little bit shorter than usual.
He's not quite as big as Betances, I don't think.
Not as bulky, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, you know, Betances is a big dude.
He's a monster.
Yeah, you know, he's a scary-looking guy on the mound.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, he's... You know, you put him on top of that hill, and that's 7.5 feet worth of baseball coming at you.
That's terrifying.
You know, the Yankees also had this guy. What was this guy's name? I think Jordan Montgomery, I think, was his name.
People are talking about him as
I saw him pitch. Really impressive. He's a 6'6 left-hander who throws directly over the top, and most left-handers don't. He kind of has a funky delivery where he tilts his head towards the third base side when he pitches. He throws four-seamer, two-seamer, slider, curveball, change.
Wow.
And he's got late movement, particularly on the two-seam fastball.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him strike out 8 guys in 4 1/3 innings. I guess a pretty representative Tampa Bay team. He got Longoria twice.
Wow, that's the guy there.
Yeah. And they basically threw him out there because he had pitched. They had that combined no-hitter that Tanaka had started, and this guy threw the last 4 innings. Mm. And they were getting nothing out of their fourth and fifth starter candidates. So Joe Girardi, the manager, just said, let's give this guy a shot. And they liked it. So, but they don't need a fifth starter until the third turn through the rotation.
Wow.
So conceivably, he could go back to AAA and get a starter to win. And then if they decide that it's him, then they can bring him up.
Bernie Pleskoff said he saw Chris Sale. I think that's a really tough comp to make in Montgomery, but it sounds like he's a really exciting arm as far as future. You know, I don't think he's a Chris Sale clone.
I have not met Bernie. He covered one of the games I was at because I remember reading his name on a credential.
Sure.
But he's seen a lot more baseball than a lot of people. I hesitate making those kind of comparisons only because probably 80% of the time you're usually wrong.
Mm-hmm. But he's an intriguing arm. I mean,
oh yeah,
they're going
to. He's certainly. I could see some of the similarities. You know, he's a big guy. He's hard to pick up his ball, late movement.
Yeah.
They're
going to really have to piece that rotation together after this year if Tanaka opts out and Sabathia is a free agent. So it's interesting to see all these arms.
That's a long way down the road.
Yeah.
So let's get back to these
guys. Bullpen, the rotation, it seems like you didn't have any gripes. I think Mejia, Barrios, they might turn over 60% of this rotation at some point this year.
Yeah.
Santiago probably doesn't finish the year with the Twins because he probably gets traded.
I kind of like
he's super intriguing.
Well, the thing is, he's a smart guy and he knows how to pitch, and he can be very helpful to some of the younger guys on the staff.
He might end up
staying longer than you think. I mean, we'll have to see. I mean,
yeah.
Obviously, if he's good, there's you know, he's got more value.
Sure,
but I was really just impressed talking to him a little bit in spring training, that he's just a really smart, savvy guy, and they need a lot of those guys.
Yeah. And, well, so no gripes in the five. There will be guys passing through that filtered through at the point of the year. I feel like the bullpen is where we're going to have probably the most gripes here. The gimmies are Kinsler, Presley, Rogers, Breslow, and Belisle, right?
I would think so, yeah.
And so that leaves two spots. I'm going with the 7-man bullpen. This is going to be unpopular, but I'm going with Justin Haley and Michael Tonkin. And I know that neither of those names are going to run people's...
Tonkin's out of options.
Right. And Haley you have to keep as the Rule 5 guy. I think that those are the safest moves. They've already sent out Shagua. They want more righties.
I saw him. He was not good.
Not good. Yeah, he's going to need some...
Lack of control, I assume? He has velocity.
Well, him and Boshers were the two guys that got hammered in that one game that I saw against, who was it, against the Orioles? Sure. I forget who it was. These days are all running together. I was only down there a week and the days ran together. But those two guys were just – they combined on one inning and gave up like five runs. They were both terrible. And I was – again, small sample, but I was just not very impressed. So.
Well, and for me, though, it's the two guys already on the 40. Adding Wimmers is even more complicated. Now, if Tonkin doesn't make the team, in theory he's off the 40 because you got to make a move either to outright him or just outright cut him. So you've basically got I feel like they'll take the safe approach with the guys already on the 40 with the idea that if Shagua strikes out 12 batters in his first 8 innings, he can come up. They can go get let's see, who are my last players out? Barrios, Shagua, Boshiers, Alex Wimmers, not on the 40. Hasn't hurt himself this spring, but
he's had a decent spring. Yeah.
He could be a long guy. Yeah. But then you're not keeping I don't think you're keeping Wimmers and Haley. Because you can't have two long guys. I think you keep Haley, who you're not going to throw into the fire. Tonkin, you can cut relatively quickly if he gives up 4 home runs in his first couple appearances. I went safe with the bullpen, and maybe I'll be sorry. Is there a differing line of thought from you?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that Ryan O'Rourke got hurt. I mean, I imagine that he's going to open the year on the DL. I think he would have been a nice option for them. Again, they've... I was talking to a scout about this yesterday. Very rarely does a major league team take their best 25 guys north because there are all kinds of little things like this. There's, well, we got to keep a guy because he's out of options or he's not out of 40 and all this. So you probably keep your best 20, and then the last 5 are all negotiable. And there are all kinds of little things like this. I would, it's hard to tell just yet what they think of Tonkin. Because they haven't really tipped their hands. The fact that they've gone so late in spring training carrying 40-some-odd guys is interesting to me, but it also shows that the new regime, that they're willing to give everybody long looks. And sometimes these decisions get made for you. Sometimes a guy gets hurt late in spring. Sometimes you're able to trade somebody. There's a lot of stuff that can happen, particularly in the last 4 or 5 days, where we can sit here and then discuss things. I don't think I saw Haley pitch at all, so I can't really. I think he might have pitched in a game when I was inside talking to a starting pitcher. So
fairly good chance.
Yeah. So I can't really offer an opinion on the guy.
I think he's 90-92 with a little funk. He's got that weird windup. I don't know. There's been people that have read that have said it's off to the side and it's a little weird and. You take a chance with a guy like that. You're not going to offer him back for nothing if it comes down to him versus keeping a guy with options. Or if it came down to him or Tonkin, maybe you take the guy that you don't know much about.
Yeah. Well, and again, they'll pick up a roster spot when Perkins. I think what they're going to do, they haven't confirmed this, but I think what they're going to do is they're going to put Perkins on the 60-day DL and leave him in Fort Myers to continue to build up arm strength. Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes the most sense. It seems kind of silly to – because now the other DL is now 10 days.
Yeah.
And it seems silly to put him on the 10-day DL because he hasn't even pitched in a game yet. I mean, my guess is that he's probably not even going to be ready. And again, this is just a guess, that he's probably not going to be ready to even pitch in a game till probably May. And if you're going to have to wait that long, and they seem bound and determined to wait until Perkins is absolutely healthy and ready to pitch rather than rush him. So the 60 makes the most sense, and it's kind of silly to bring him up here and have him pitch when it's throw an occasional bullpen when it's 45 degrees. I mean, just leave him someplace extended spring where it's
well, and
nice.
You can put him on a 30-day rehab. If he's ready to pitch in a game on May 1st, a 30-day rehab, June 1st, you got 60 days right there.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to make the most sense, and they're going to need a roster spot. So.
Yeah, and I don't think that, if Adrianza hadn't made the team, that's a 40 spot. If Tonga doesn't make the team, that's a 40 spot. So there are layers, but some of the out of options guys, Polanco, obviously ironclad, Eduardo Escobar, barring a trade. I think Escobar or Grossman would be the guys to watch for any kind of late spring trades.
Yeah.
I wrote about maybe trading Grossman now. I don't know that he's got a ton of value, but I also don't know if he's got a ton of a chance to replicate what he did. If some team sees what he did against lefties, 4 years of club control, and says, hey, we'll give you a B-plus relief prospect for him, It might give them a longer look at Danny Santana, who they can flip and bring up Zach Granite. There's a lot of layers. So I think
Let me tell you something, Brandon. Every team has a guy like Robbie Grossman.
Fair.
Just like when people were talking about last year about Trevor Plouffe, every team has a guy like Trevor Plouffe. Yeah, and what it means is that, you know, he's just a corner guy, decent power, decent fielder. Basically, he's Mike Moustakas, but not as good.
Sure.
And every team at least thinks that they have a guy like this. So there's really not a whole lot of value in that guy. You know, maybe you get lucky. Well, and Grossman's also got that groin strain.
I think he came through a minor league game today. I think I just
did
saw
he?
But I mean, it is something to think about.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that a guy is close to heel and they put him on a DL just to free up a roster.
And maybe J.B. Shuck makes it.
Well, there could be a lot of ways. See, that guys that get hurt late in camp, you know, they're always – that's what I'm saying. Like, particularly guys that get hurt the last week, there are always ways to kind of manipulate the roster to take care of certain guys. Mm-hmm. And like Vargas, I got to think that he I got to think that he starts the year on the DL simply because he got hurt so late.
It has to be the MLB DL, I think, too. At some
Yeah.
So,
I mean, he's got one option because he petitioned for the additional option here. I mean, they could option him. They should send him to AAA. But they could also put him on a DL. So, either way, they could take care of him or finagle a way to keep somebody else and not him.
So overall, not a lot of gripes on the 25-man roster.
It's not a good team.
Well,
you know?
It's true.
I mean, they're it's not like they have, you know, 15 relief pitchers that they could keep. Whatever the team is on April 3rd is probably unlikely to be the team on May 3rd.
Yeah.
I think what you're going to see this year is you're going to see a lot of movement, a lot of up and down, and just a lot of mixing. I mean, Mahler wasn't even certain about how he was going to use the bullpen. I think that he probably also didn't want to tip his hand on who they think is going to make the team. We'll see how it all works out. I mean, I think this is going to be – I get asked a lot, are these guys going to be better than last year? And I tell people, keep your expectations low, be patient, and let's see where they are in August.
Well, tune in to see how spectacularly wrong we are on our roster predictions. See you on Monday?
Yeah.
That's Pat Borzy, Tom Schreier joining us as well. I'm Brandon Warren. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.